are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Berkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? It's maddening. This will be our final discussion about that show. Also, do you think there are too many Republicans running for president? Some GOP honchos think so, but guess what? There's more to come. Also, inspiration to action, challenge, success stories, and you on the line if you're listening live. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. And don't forget about our 24/7 Twitter feed. If you're listening on podcasts, you can chime in on anything and everything whenever you're ready at AB Wright. The show today brought to you in part by Kellogg's. Wake up, breakfast is waiting. And by Audiophile, from music to books to podcasts. Caress your ears with everything you want to hear at Audiophile. So, as you know, occasionally I suffer from insomnia, and it does have its perks. I think I mentioned this a month or so ago. I stumbled upon this fascinating documentary on PBS. It's heartbreaking. It's beautifully told. It's the story of a young mother, former actress and playwright Lori Sachs, who had a set of weird symptoms. She was losing herself, losing her ability to speak and communicate. Unfortunately, as the movie reveals, she suffered from a form of dementia that strikes people in their prime of their lives, and it really took her life, destroyed her life at a very young age, very rapidly. Two of her friends documented those final steps in the journey in this compelling film. Looks like Lori, sounds like Lori. Pamela Hogan is the director and producer. Connie Shulman is the producer. You also may know Connie as an actress. She's on Orange is the New Black and other shows and films. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on this compelling and heart-wrenching film.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks.
Glad to have you both here. Let's talk about how you decided to make this film. I know it was something that was very important to Lori. She was very aware of it, wanted to participate in it. I think, Connie, you were the one that came up with the idea. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Well, once the, I guess the cat was out of the bag, where we knew that there was something neurologically going on with Lori, that my husband actually mentioned to me that a great way to sort of keep her engaged and stimulated would be to document what was going on with her. And Lori had been an actress, and she had written a memoir, so she was clearly a storyteller. And when I broached her on the subject, in her own way, she sort of took leadership of the project. She got her cell phone out and dialed a number and said hello to someone on the other line and handed me the phone. And it was Pam on the other end, who had also been a very close friend of Lori's and knew how to make documentaries. So she connected us both with actually very, very few words. And so the project started as a way to keep her participating in the world and in her own life.
Sure. But, you know, it's interesting because when the film starts, we don't really, or did you know already and you backtracked that what her exactly was wrong with her?
Oh, no.
It was still baffling.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, you didn't know.
We didn't. You know, frontotemporal dementia, which was ultimately what she had, and that was her final diagnosis, It's always misdiagnosed. Some people get as many as eight misdiagnoses because it's very hard. It's a very hard disease to know what's going on, and even her neurologist was really baffled. So they didn't know what she had. And, you know, the hope was that it was not a progressive brain disease, that it was not Alzheimer's, that it was not FTD, that maybe she'd had some kind of a, you know, an injury, maybe through a drug that she took, a medicine that she took, and that she could get her faculties back. So when we started filming, that was really the hope.
Yeah, I know. I think I read that you said that. You were hoping, this is not the film I wanted to make. I was really hoping to see the recovery. And unfortunately,
yeah,
that's not what happened. Really heartbreaking to see it. And it really was a pretty rapid succession, right? I mean, she was losing. What happens at first? She just started losing ability to speak, language. She was grappling for words. I mean, it doesn't seem that severe at first, but then it rapidly got worse. Is that right?
Right. Well, I didn't have a history with Lori. So she was a new friend. So she actually, we came into each other's life when this disease had already started to take its toll. And to me, I mean, I would say for her, the symptoms were something called expressive aphasia, where she had lost the ability to express herself, to have original thoughts, to be able to have a spontaneous idea. So for 10 months, my first 10 months with her, she would be parroting back what I was asking her, a lot of yes-nos, sort of her answers would restructure something that I had already said. So she had begun to lose the ability to express her own thoughts.
Which, but it felt like she was, it felt like she was having them. I mean, it felt like there was this disconnect, that she was thinking clearly, but that her mouth wasn't, you know, forming the words the way she would want to form them, you know. And then, and yeah, then every once in a while, she'd come out with a full-blown sentence. I saw some friends the other day who reminded me that at one of my husband's birthday parties, they sat next to Lori. This was around the time we had started making the film. And although she was quiet most of the dinner, at one point they turned, and she was watching their daughter, and their daughter's about 2 years old and was misbehaving. And she looked at the daughter and she said, "You should really listen to your mom and dad." So she could, she had these moments of lucidity, and you know, and then you'd kind of trick yourself into thinking that maybe she was going to get better.
So it's so interesting the way the human brain works, and that you do have, and this is true with Alzheimer's patients as well. I mean, they do have these flashes of lucidity, and then you retreat back to the symptoms of the disease again. It's so fascinating and scary for a lot of people. And this was a woman young. She was in her mid-40s when the symptoms first took hold. You do show that she was excited about doing the film. I mean, you could tell, you know, because some people might say, well, was it exploitive? Did she know what it was doing? But, you know, I think you make it pretty clear that this is something that she would love, because she was someone who enjoyed the spotlight, enjoyed acting, enjoyed the arts, expressing herself, and knew about it. She wanted to do this. She wanted to document it. So while she was still as lucid as she could be, she gave the go-ahead. And so much so that after she had really plummeted, and she was living in a, I guess, assisted care facility, for a while, one of her closest friends who knew her for years said she wanted to do one more set of filming, right? Is that, tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, Connie and I checked in with her husband constantly through this whole process, just to say, well, how do you think it's going, and should we keep shooting? And he told us that she was so up for it every time we came, you know, just keep going. And we could see that, you can see that in the film. She's constantly playing to the camera. Yeah, and then at the end, it was Connie and I felt like we'd kind of, the way Connie would put it is, we have a sacred trust with Lori, and now that she's in assisted living, you know, it just doesn't feel that was really the agreement with Lori, that we'd go this far. But her best friend Lois and her husband, you know, spent a day convincing us otherwise a couple years later, and that she would want to be true. She'd never hid. She liked to tell her story, as Connie said, and she would write articles, and she was working on a memoir, and she wasn't hiding the bad parts. She was telling the whole thing. That was who Lori was. She was really uninhibited, and she just liked herself, and she, you know, that's one of the reasons that people were so drawn to her. She was willing to just sort of put it all out there, the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Yeah. So the last scene when you see her, how much time had passed? Because you really did have a precipitous drop in her appearance and the way she could express herself. I mean, that was close to the end, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know, was that a couple of years that she was at the facility? Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, like, it was so tricky. Like, when I look at the film, it was such, like, I don't know, it didn't feel like a smooth decline, anything like that. It was bumpy, very bumpy, and sort of up and down. And so I think that was about 2 years later when we revisited her at the greens with the camera.
But I think something it's important to say is that we, you know, throughout, and even as she was really compromised, there was so much life and humor and zest in her.
Right.
I mean, it's not a grim film to watch. She's full of life. She's like in there swinging. Didn't you feel that way, Connie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've had so many people ask me, you know, I didn't see a lot of tears. I didn't see people crying. And it's because she wasn't crying. She was up for the party. She was full of pip and zest. And I think that was the essence of who she was. And to the very end, where she is still managing to laugh at something her friend's telling her. So, you know, she was losing pieces of herself gradually, but I do think that the dementia did not touch the core of who Lori was, and that was somebody that was definitely up for the game of life. And so her friends and her family, we followed her cue. And I think an audience, viewers who will be watching this, if they know someone that is going through a similar disease, they will see a friend holding their hand. And I wish that we had had a film like this when we were experiencing this journey with Lori. And it's like she is walking through this with all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well said. Well, you're right. I mean, you do see that she still loves life. She's still going for it, even though she's losing herself and she doesn't always understand what's happening. And she, you know, it's like the determination to get better and all of those things that you see, and the frustrations. You know, she has at one point when they give her a full-time caretaker or caretakers. I don't know if there were more than one. And you know, the frustrations that she has that she can't be independent. And she wants to be independent and all of that kind of thing. It's fascinating to watch. It really is, and it is heartbreaking because you see her, you know, going and drifting. But you're right, it's life affirming in so many ways as well because she's battling it, and you see that life force to wanting to stay the course and keep going. And the friendships that she has. I mean, there were a lot of people in the movie, a lot of friends. Obviously, as you said, she was someone who was very engaged with life before all this happened, and had a lot of contacts and a big. Oh, not a Rolodex, but a big black book, I guess, you know, a big address book.
right. And you have to remember that
what
she's
was it like
not
to
an
do
elderly
it day-to-day,
person.
Though, for you guys, as you said, you would like to have had this kind of primer for yourself as you were filming it. I mean, did you clearly you thought about the sacred trust that you call it, documentary ethics that you obviously have with your subject, and I'm sure Pam, as you made other films, this was a very personal one because this was somebody who you really knew. What was it like, though, the day-to-day for you, filming it and seeing her and knowing you were making a film? I mean, did you have a lot of back and forth about what should go in, what shouldn't go in, and when you got to the editing process, were there things that you left out because you thought this was too exposing her in some ways?
Well, first of all, as Connie said, she became the leader of the project. Lori became the leader of the project. The day after Connie broached this idea of making a film, we all met for a cup of coffee to talk about it, to see if she really meant it. Well, not only did she mean it, she brought her little black book. She led the meeting. She opened it up, and she pointed to who could be in it and who she didn't want to be in it.
Okay.
She did the casting. She cast the film for us. And as we went along, we would talk to Eric at the beginning of every week, what's on Lori's agenda this week, deciding when to shoot things when people were coming, but also wanting to shoot sometimes when people weren't there. And that was the most revealing of all. That's when no one really knows what's going on in the life of someone who's suffering these kinds of symptoms until you're there just with a camera at moments when she's alone with no one to mediate the experience. And that's when sort of the depth of the confusion became so obvious. As far as leaving things out in the editing room, there were some things we left out, mostly because we didn't want her children to see them. They went through enough pain, and although we go pretty deep with this film in showing some of the pain and the pathos, there were just certain things that just felt, no, you know, that's not something that the kids should ever have to see. And that's where, you know, being a friend enters. You know, you're not just a filmmaker. You know, I'm a friend. And you try and think about that every time you're making a film. You know, you try and be careful of crossing lines. But you know, there's always that impulse to go for the most dramatic. Well, frankly, what happened to Lori and what you do see in the film is so dramatic that there were just lines we didn't have to cross and that we didn't want to cross.
Speaking of her family, how did they react, or how have they reacted to it? I'm assuming that her husband has seen it. I don't know about how old the kids are, if they've seen it yet.
Her husband, Right. Eric was a huge force in making this film, because you can't make a film like this without him being on board. We were going into their lives. He was her caretaker. And not only were we going into Lori's lives, we were going into his life also. And so he was so on board with it and such a big participant, and provided a lot of what was going on medically with her, a big sounding board, and has been on board with the various drafts of this film the whole way, and was with us at our, you know, sort of intimate screening of this film, and both of their kids gave us the blessing the night that it sort of aired publicly, and which was it was beautiful. You know, they're older now. Everybody has grown up and is growing up, and you see Tally, and you see her mother all in her. And but Eric was a huge participant in this film, and don't you agree, Pam? We could not have done it without him.
No, I would never have done it without him. And he says that he wishes he'd had a film like this, because when at the time that Lori was going through these problems, because he went to various Alzheimer's associations and different people to try and help families who have a loved one with dementia. And, you know, they tried to be helpful. They'd give him literature. But there's no roadmap, and there's nothing like seeing experientially, you know, sort of day by day, what another family has gone through and recognizing the commonality in it. You feel less alone, and, you can take comfort in it. People tell us who have seen this film that it resonates with all kinds of things that have happened to people they love. You know, someone who had a father with a brain tumor. He said, you know, your film made me feel not alone. I see my suffering in the suffering of someone else, and I feel not alone. So Eric has been fabulous, and he loved Lori so much and loved who she was, and who Lori was someone who wanted to tell her story. So even though Eric is a more private person, he honored that about his wife, and I think that's really special. It was very courageous of him.
Yeah, very beautiful. It's so beautifully told, and congratulations on this effort. As you said, you're already helping so many people, I think. I believe it's available for people to see it on demand. Is that right, or is it available on DVD? Where can people watch this?
Well, people can watch it through June 9th on America Reframed on the World Channel. If you just Google, Looks Like Lori, Sounds Like Lori, America Reframed, they can find the link. And also we have a website, lookslikelori.com, and they can go to that website and communicate with us. We do have a DVD, and there's screenings being set up all over the country. And there's also some other resources on that website for people who may have somebody who has this kind of problem.
That's great. We'll post both of those links so people will be able to see it on Twitter and Facebook. So anybody wants
thank
to
you.
Get the link, they can get it. Thank you guys so much for coming on and talking to us about it. It's an important topic. Unfortunately, it's something which a lot of people are going to be facing, a loved one going through this or going through it themselves. And to have these resources, I think, is so great. And it's just a very compelling film, even if you're not going through that. See, as you said, the life force of this woman and all the love that surrounded her and the people that loved her, her children, her husband, her friends. Clearly she was someone who was loved and had a great, vibrant life, and unfortunately was cut down way too early. And it's a beautiful film. Looks Like Lori, Sounds Like Lori, Pamela Hogan, Connie Shulman, thank you so much for joining us. Best success with this and all your other future projects. And good luck, Connie, with Orange is the New Black. I know you're in season whatever, you're in 4 or 5 right now.
Season 3 will be airing soon. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care, ladies. Appreciate
it. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Pamela Hogan, Connie Shulman, pleasure having them there. The film is It Looks Like Lori, Sounds Like Lori. Again, we will post all the information that you need on the Twitter feed. Reach out via Twitter. Amy Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Yeah, we'll be talking Mad Men next. that's how it ended, the famous Coca-Cola commercial. It's the real thing. On the Amy Beth Berkowitz Show, we're talking, of course, about the iconic show Mad Men. Loved it, hated it. What do you think about the finale? Lots of people talking. I've gotten into some social media dust-ups. I was disappointed. I know. A lot of people loved it. I figured I'd be disappointed no matter what it was because I love that show so much I don't want to see it go. But there were some very great moments, for sure. We had some conversations with people who said, hey, it's brilliant, it's great, it's the best thing ever. There were flourishes of brilliance. There was a symmetry. I get it. Don coming full circle and winding up back in advertising with this iconic ad. I get all of that. People pointed out that McCann Erickson, the actual real-life version of that agency, created that Coca-Cola commercial. Also, by the way, I think it's important to note, and I think a few people have chimed in via social media and our blog about the fact that it was originally a late 60s hit for the New Seekers, written as kind of a, not really a protest song, but a song to unite people and bring peace. It's, you know, I'd like to teach the world to sing, nothing to do with Coca-Cola. They sold out, sold it to the ad world, as so many popular songs do, and became that popular, iconic commercial. But what's your take? Let's hear about it. Our final time to do this, because, you know, enough is enough. AB writes on the Twitter feed and the phone line 347-857-4505. It will certainly be much talked about, still is. Here we go. Somebody just said, you know, Roger Cook and Roger Greenaway wrote the song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. It was written as a call for peace for our world. It fell on deaf ears. Shame on USA. The song was not written for a Coke commercial. That's right, Mel. You're right. True. I just said that. But unfortunately, it's very true today. I don't know if that was one of the earlier songs that was captured by the ad world and turned into a commercial. But many of them are done today, for sure. This is interesting. Turtle Dove writes, I scandalize my child. What does that mean? What is he referring to? I was baffled by that comment, too. If anybody know, when he calls Peggy, and that's one of the most emotional scenes, when Don is kind of spiraling out of control and in grips of some sort of post-traumatic depression episode or something at the retreat, he calls Peggy, and when she says, well, what is all the bad things you've done? And he goes through the litany, and one of the things is, I scandalized my child. And I saw the finale a few times, and I said, I'm not sure what that means. Because what? What did he do to his child? And why is it one child? He has three children. So that's interesting. Or is there another child going on? And also, Turtle Dove says, also at Esalen, the Est retreat, or something like that, I don't know if they exactly said it was, but most people believe it was, after Stephanie runs out of the group session, he says to her something to the effect, you weren't raised on Jesus, or did I hear that wrong? What does that mean? Well, I think what I take from that is he grew up, his stepmother was a very religious woman, and she was always, in the most negative sense of the word, quoting the Bible and all of that. So I think that's kind of where it comes from. Rosie says, did anyone notice the visual reference to Marlo Thomas in That Girl, the first independent single woman to be betrayed positively on a TV series? Rosie says, when Trudy boarded the private plane with Pete, I thought that was a great touch. Interesting. I don't know. I don't know if I noticed that. A lot of people chiming in. Mike says, I was also disappointed by the finale's failure to approach a moment of reconciliation between Don, Betty, and Sally. This was my big bugaboo. I think the telephone calls that so many people thought were so great between Sally and Betty were very moving, but what I found false there was the hell or high water trip home he did not take. It seemed too simple and too manipulative. That's the point where I felt really felt the manipulation most. Now, as a writer, I know you have to manipulate things here and there. The trick is you want to finesse it so it doesn't feel like manipulation. Don finds out Betty's dying. His first reaction is the most authentic. I'm coming right home. Sally says, oh, don't do that. I've already betrayed her trust. You have to tell her the kids should stay with Henry. She wants to send them off to the uncle and aunt. So he then, you know, first he resists and he says, you know, I have to make those decisions. Adults make those decisions. He gets off the phone with Sally, calls Betty. Betty says similar things. Oh, don't ruin my wishes because of your pride, something to that effect. I thought this out. He needs to stay with my brother and his wife because they need a female presence, all of that. And he goes off, gets drunk, and takes a little trip to see Stephanie and his niece and then winds up at the retreat. It just didn't ring true to me. It didn't make sense. It was too simple. It was sort of like, okay, they were giving him permission to not come home, and he took it. His initial reaction was, I'm coming right home. So when you say don't come home, you still do it. It's your family. And I really thought it was going to wind up with him coming home, too, because part of his quest for redemption is to be the good father that he wants to be, to have the good family that he never had but wants to have. And futzing around in California isn't going to get him that. So I'm with you, Mike. I kind of agree with that. And he goes on to say, this was what I most was looking forward to, and I'd assumed, albeit incorrectly, that Betty's tragic fate was to be used as a device to drive this very reunion, to bring him home. Exactly. What was exactly my reaction. I said, well, then what's the point? Why do you have to kill off Betty if he's not coming home? Not getting the chance to see these three in the same location before the series Swan Song was upsetting, but I would see a movie version. Okay, so if they have a movie version of it, are they talking about that now? They would do it. Okay, I'm on the same page with you, Mike. I was so disappointed because of the very thing. But it got to the point where I saw the finale a couple of times, and then with people talking about how great it was, I rationalized it in my head that he was at the retreat for a few days, and that after that, because he's going to come home with a smirk on his face to create the Coke commercial, while he's home, he's going to take care of the family. I mean, that was my broad, bold assumption on that. But I was very, very disappointed, too, because I really thought he was going to come home. Now, I know maybe it was a long shot because it would be too sentimental, but Matthew Weiner did put a lot of bows on a lot of things that he didn't have to do. I mean, the Peggy and Stan connection really felt manufactured. Yeah, they had a long-standing, bantering relationship, brother and sister, more it would seem. People do fall in love in the workplace, for sure. I get it. They should have made it more, dropped a little more clues than just being jealous with each other over some hustler photographer seducing both of them. It just seemed too little too late, and like they were pushing them together. And very awkward, that phone scene when he confesses his love to her, and she says, well, I don't really think of you. Oh, wait, you're always here. Yes, I do. I think I love you, too. Did not ring true at all. So if he can put a bow on that, and he can put a bow on Trudy and Pete getting a second chance, which actually felt the most authentic, that, yeah, Pete Campbell, who was sleazy and slimy and smarmy and all that, but had glimmers throughout the series of a man with a conscience in some areas and trying to be better and fighting his existential demons, that kind of made sense. Now, we're not saying it's going to be happy ever after, but they have a chance at a second chance, whether he blows it or not, who knows. But that felt realer than Peggy and Stan, and frankly, Roger and Marie. You're thinking, well, okay, why doesn't Roger go with Joan already? Because that would be too obvious. Well, you know, again, sometimes the obvious works, I think. Cindy says, I think the entire series can be summed up in one line I heard when Don informed his latest girlfriend that they were through because he had married Megan. She yelled as he was walking away, I hope she knows you only like the beginnings of things. The latest girlfriend? I don't know. Oh, that was that Faye? This was a couple of seasons ago, I guess, right? And Prairie Flax says, would someone please talk about the symphonic music that was played toward the end of what, as we see what happens to Joan, Peggy, Roger, Sally, and Pete, it sounded funereal or nostalgic. But I don't have the music education, so I could be wrong. And Josh says, I'm not sure what it was. It seemed to me to be intentionally the opposite of the anxious, unsettled theme music. Things are finally settling and resolved. I don't think they're resolved, that's for sure. But I do think Don will be leaving California at some point.
madman.
Of a captive bird.
Time you saw Don Draper's face, or Roberta Flack and her beautiful 1971 hit, I believe it was, on the Amy Beth Arcui Show, a song that was featured in the last season of that iconic show. Also, The Doors, Hello, I Love You, Won't You Tell Me Your Name, featured in the final episode, and so appropriate as we see Don trying to reconcile Dick Whitman and Don Draper throughout the series. America with a song that wasn't in the series, but kind of felt like it should have been that last episode. Everyone I Know is from California. But Don will be heading back east. At least that's my theory. And the way I can live with the ending. The Amy Beth Arcui Show, reach out. Your final thoughts on the Mad Men finale. AB writes on the Twitter feed, phone line 347-857-4505. Pearlie says, what a jip. I wanted that reunion too between Don, Betty, and Sally. Yeah, you kept thinking that one scene when Sally comes in the kitchen, that Don is going to come in the kitchen. Fascinating. Everything, you know, obviously, somebody said, well, it's brilliant because he clearly thought about every possible thing, meaning Matthew Weiner. And I'm like, yeah, of course he thought about it. That doesn't mean I have to like it. And, of course, you know, I'm loath to criticize other writers because people make their choices, and it's his masterpiece, and it is a masterful series. There's no question about it. I knew I'd be disappointed no matter how it ended because you don't want to see it end. I mean, that's all part of it. But we'll quibble, and we have a right to quibble because that's what it's about. You know, if you put your work out into the world, people are going to take it on and do with it what they will. Unfortunately, that's the downside of being a creative artist, or the upside, because it's fun to see what people, how people react to it as well. So, interesting stuff indeed. Speaking of which, what are other finales? It starts to think about like other series finales and how good they were or not. I think the most watched series finale was MASH. I don't know whether it was good or bad. I watched MASH a little bit, but not that much. The ones I think that stood out to me: Mary Tyler Moore, classic. It's so funny. And then they're all sitcoms that stand out to me. Newhart, the second Newhart, when he was having the dream, that's got to be the classic. He wakes up with Suzanne Plachet, who was the wife in the first Bob Newhart show, and says, I just had this weird dream that I was an innkeeper in Vermont and all these people were crazy. That was perfect. And I think Will and Grace was great when they have years later in the future and their two kids, Grace's daughter and it's Grace's daughter and Will's son are both going to the same college. And then they go back and they flash back to real time at the bar. I think that was very clever and well done. So, intriguing. Do you have any other favorite series endings of iconic shows? Reach out. Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. So, sorry to see it go. Some great stuff in there, though. Really some fascinating things to think about, and a show that really was not a big, fat hit. You know, it was a critical hit, for sure. It was a cult hit. I mean, people who love it, love it, as you know. But a lot of people just never watched it. And maybe that's why I like it even more, because it had that puts you in a special group. It has a literary feel to it. It is really not for everybody. It's slower paced. It's a character study, or character studies of so many different characters, and so wonderful. Some people, I'm sorry, they never brought back Sal Romano. I kept thinking they were going to bring back the art director who got short shrifted and fired unsummarily because of that lucky strike flying ball, so that he made a pass at him when it was really the other way around. And Sal, of course, who back in the 60s was someone who was gay, closeted, had to be closeted, got married. But Don Draper, on a business trip, saw him with another man in a hotel room, and he knew his secret, kept his secret, until it hurt the business, and then had to get rid of him. He did. Just tossed him on the street, and we never saw him. And I think I read an article with Brian Batt, who played Sal so well, and what a great, I don't know, vulnerability, pathos. Just the acting in this show also gets short shrifted because he never really won any. I think that maybe a couple of Golden Globes. Never an Emmy for John Hamm. I think this is going to be the year. Bryan Cranston's out of the picture. And if you watch it, and I dipped into the marathon quite a bit over the weekend, and you can just see how much goes into the acting of these roles. I mean, not just John Hamm, although this last episode alone could get him the Emmy, just the emotion of it, the breakdown of the phone, the reconciliation with that guy Leonard, who has the you know, was left over in the fridge, in reconciling his life between Dick and Don. I think he's got the Emmy for this one, I think, finally. But a lot of the acting, Christina Hendricks for sure, Elizabeth Moss, of course, The Evolution of Peggy, January Jones, even her limited Betty role, but you could see it and what goes into that. John Slattery, I mean, they're all just so great, and they really deserve a lot of accolades. And they've gotten them as far as the whole show itself and writing, but no for the acting, really. Not in the Emmys, anyway. I think they have gotten some Golden Globes, and they may have won. They probably won the Screen Actors Guild Ensemble Award at some point because they really are such a great ensemble. Wow, it's hard to go. But I saw Brian Batt on the show, and he said that there was talk that Matthew Weiner wanted to bring Sal back at some point, but it just didn't work out. And he said, you know, he doesn't... it wasn't organic to the story, and he wouldn't do it. But he said, I hope Sal's doing all right. I like to believe he is. But what a tough slog. And the other thing I realized watching it, I mean, just what a tough slog women had. I don't think I could cut it. I mean, I don't like the corporate structure as it is now. But a woman back then, Peggy and Joan, what they had to endure, what they had to go through to pave the way for as good as it really isn't quite where it should be now, and with equal pay, et cetera, still in the balance. But wow, how hard it was then. And Peggy making the choice to stick it out in McCann because she might become a creative director by 1980. Did you see that scene when Pete said, well, by 1980 you'll be a creative director, and this is 1970? And she says, well, that seems so long ago, long from now. But what it took, not that it doesn't take a long time now for both men and women, but it took even more for women to climb that ladder and be seen. And what a great scene that was with Pete and Peggy and their history when he said, well, someday you'll see it'll happen. People will say they remembered working with you and what a thrill it was. And she says, wow, you know, can you imagine saying something like that? And he said, no, because nobody's ever said it to me. where Pete sort of comes around. And then, of course, you had Harry Crane. Poor Rich Summer, you had to see his character kind of start out as a lovable schlub and devolve into a sleazy schlub. I mean, I was thinking about, of all the characters, Harry Crane probably had the least evolution, and it wasn't in the right direction, for sure. But you have to hope that Sal and Paul Kinsey, the guy who went off, the copywriter who joined the Harry Krishnas and wanted to be a TV writer, broke out and did just that. I know in that Mako bit that people were circulating last week, they said that Ginsberg, the guy who they carted off because he went crazy over the computer, in the obit said he was a famous film director, and he said, Don Draper drove me crazy, and when I went crazy, I got famous. So, there you go. Fascinating show. We'll be watching it again, I'm sure. It's available now on DVD, demand. If you haven't gotten into the series, you want to get into it, it's certainly one for the ages. Great work, and the imaginations run wild. I don't think there's going to be a reunion or a film, but who knows? You know, you never know about these things. They always talked about The Sopranos, and unfortunately now that the great James Gandolfini has passed on, that will not happen. There was some talk about making it into a movie and so forth, the sequel, because folks were so disappointed with that ending. I don't think we're as disappointed here. There's a little more finality to this one. I thought there would be. I was just curious as to the places they wrapped up that bow. Peggy and Stan, particularly the most confounding, and I think a lot of people are not crazy about that one. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505 if you want to reach out because, you know, time is still on your side for a few more minutes, and Heinz is on your side. Remember when they wanted to turn the Rolling Stone hit into a Heinz campaign?
Always say Is it a case of too much too soon or too little too late?
You'll never know how much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care.
Show, do you want to know a secret? Well, you know most of the secrets that we'll get to know. One more thought from the blog from Armando, who says, we could have figured Don was going to do some therapizing before it was over, and the Coke Hillside ad was one of those theories floating about, but the Esalen scenes were cliche, wooden, and unconvincing, that in the end Don is still an exploiting, advertising savant without a humanizing, connecting face-to-face rather than person-to-person moment with his family. Whilst the fur-wrapped Campbells bounce into their jet, seems a little stingy on Weiner's part. So I'm left in the space that Weiner always wanted us to be, contemplating between what was, or what, I'm sorry, what we want and what we have. Bravo. All deliberate indeed. Speaking of deliberations, how many Republicans are too many in the 2016 presidential landscape? Intriguing question, but some honchos in the party, and some commentators too, I guess, think there are too many already and more to follow. Somebody commented, there's so many candidates, forget the clown car, as some folks call it, we need a clown Winnebago to cart them all over town and more to follow. The latest, who I think will get into the fray, he pretty much declared it on CBS's This Morning news show yesterday, but says he'll make an official announcement the 1st of June, is Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator, buddy of John McCain, who kind of sounds like he wants to be a military dictator. His speech the other day, I don't know who he was speaking to, but he said, if you're thinking about joining Al-Qaeda or ISIS or ISIL, I don't want to arrest you. I'm not going to get a, I'm not going to get a warrant to arrest you. I'm going to get a drone to kill you. crazy talk, and there'll be a lot more of it, and some people think there are too many. The debates will be out of hand, and then we'll have another one of these circuses that they had just a few years ago. We'll see. Ann Coulter, by the way, popped out of the woodwork to say, or at least I heard, I'm sure she's out of the woodwork all the time. I don't follow her on a regular basis. But I did catch her comment on who she thinks should win, should run this time. And it's curious because last time around she said, if Chris Christie isn't the nominee, we will lose. She was right. They lost. I don't know that Chris Christie is the great bargain. She's not on Chris Christie's side anymore. But this time, guess what? She wants Mitt Romney, because last time she said, if we have Romney, we'll lose. Now she says Mitt Romney should be on the top of the ticket, and Scott Walker should be his vice presidential candidate. Well, Romney so far is not in the ring, except the boxing ring when he took on Evander Holyfield for charity. Actually, he looks like he's in pretty good shape. I saw a clip of that. But he says he's out of it. Of course, you never know. Things can change, I suppose, but it's just so fascinating how many more people are entering the fray and how easy it is to enter the fray now because of the way people raise money. It's sort of similar to the way the Internet allows people to put out all their work into the world so you can have millions of books and films and music compilation, all that stuff. But to really stand out, it takes a lot more. So we'll see what happens with those debates. Speaking of which, it looks like George Stephanopoulos over at ABC News may not have a shot at moderating one of those debates because of his affiliation with the Clinton Foundation. Some, you know, ABC standing by him. This is not the same kind of a scandal as the Brian Williams scandal. But it may sideline him not from the news and his position at ABC per se, but maybe from being involved in the covering the campaign, because he does have an affiliation with the Clintons. I mean, he tried to distance himself, but he was a press secretary there, President Clinton. He was involved with their campaign and the White House for many years, has forged his own path, probably someone who would have been better off for his own career if Hillary Clinton wasn't running for president. But she is. He has an affiliation. He has been involved in speaking and also donating money, and the donating money is where it comes in kind of murky, and some people are saying he should resign and all of this. So we'll see where that plays out. And the Brian Williams thing has sort of faded for the moment anyway. They're just not talking about it. Maybe they're hoping that he will just fade. Somebody else who's fading into the sunset, and a lot of people are sorry to see him go, is David Letterman. His final episode, or show, I should say, airs tomorrow night. That will be a compilation of favorite moments, I think, and reminiscings and all that kind of stuff. But tonight, the final musical guest will be Bob Dylan. Is that not fitting? I think that's great. After a two-decade absence from the show, Bob Dylan will be the final musical guest on The Late Show with David Letterman. The veteran folk rocker will appear on the show's penultimate episode. That's tonight's. And he'll be joined by Bill Murray, as well as milestones like the last of Letterman's famous top 10 lists. The announcement harkens back to Letterman's love for classic stunts and nose-thumbing to the TV executive brass, as this will be the first time in human history that a network TV broadcast is focused on three men over the age of 60 for more than 2 minutes without reflexively panning away to someone closer to the target demo. And we had, last night was great, they had Tom Hanks and Eddie Vedder. Vedder did a great job. Vedder man, really, really moving. Tom Hanks, he was sort of funny, but they kept him on for too many segments. He might have had room for another guest. Sorry to see David Letterman go. You know, I watched sporadically. As a kid, I watched all the time. I think I mentioned my sister and I used to write letters in when he had the letters, the mailbag segment. We never got the letters on. We thought they were very creative. We had a stuffed animal that looked a lot like Paul Schaefer, and we had Polaroids at the time that we sent in. Never got read. We kept thinking it would happen when they had things like, Dave, want a biscuit? But, you know, also, the amount of mail he must have gotten, whether they were real letters or they made up the letters half the time, who knows? But we were kind of bitter about that. So for a while, I didn't want to watch the show. But I did watch it over the years. More sporadically in recent years, because I just don't watch that much late-night talk shows. I'm usually watching TV late at night trying to go to sleep, but it's usually a movie or something. But in the last couple of months, knowing that he was about to leave, I was kind of watching on a fairly regular basis. So what an interesting talent. Edgier than Leno, of course. Edgier even than Carson, his mentor. Darker, maybe, more private than Carson, if that's possible. According to Barbara Walters, she said he was probably even more private than Johnny, and you know how much you revere Johnny Carson. Did a lot, especially for musical acts. There were so many great musical acts that he would, you know, well-known people as well as people that were just starting out, like Hootie and Blowfish, I think, made their first appearance on The Letterman Show. Really a launching pad, a real advocate for musicians. You know, he loves it so much with Paul Schaefer. Don't know what Paul Schaefer is going to do. I guess he's busy with the Hall of Fame and other projects. What a character. What a great chemistry they have. And Schaefer, they had a snippet on some show where they said, well, how did you find out that he was leaving? And he said, hey, he just told me one night backstage. He said, yeah, I'm going to make the announcement. This is it. I'm leaving. Apparently, it was all his idea to go. He knew when it's time, as a former executive over at CBS who lured him away from NBC after Leno got the Tonight Show said, you know, he's a guy that knows when to go. He's a guy who really knows. He's got his pulse on things. He's a bright guy. He's up on the news. And he just felt like it was time to go. We'll see what happens. Maybe Leto and Letterman can do, like, a tour. I think he said they were going to do the tour of the Sunshine Boys, and they could also do the Odd Couple. It could work out. So, Dylan, the times are a-changing. There's a changing of the guard for sure. A final guest, we don't know what he'll sing, but it'll be tonight. Watch it or set your DVRs.
Come gather around, people. Wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are with your pen. And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Bob Dylan, Letterman's last guest tonight. Set your DVRs. On the Amy Beth Arkley Show, the times, they are a-changing, like it or not. Hey, our Inspiration to Action Challenge shout-out today to Maurice in South Dakota. Says, working on a memoir. Really like your show. Enjoy your interviews and your style. And the challenge got me rethinking my own life and priorities, and I wanted to take on a memoir. I'm trying it. We'll see how it goes. Thanks again. Well, thank you, Maurice. I hope it works for you, and please do keep us posted. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge has worked for you, give me a shout-out at the website, amybetharkowee.com, and we'll do the same for you, because I think it helps you get a little recognition and also spur on some other folks. On the other hand, you need a little cajoling in the creativity department. Let's start a conversation. First one always on me. I'll help you out. The website, again, is amybetharkowee.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed, and give me a week or so to get back to you, and I'll do it. You can also peruse my stories while you're at the website. The Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, are available for ebook and paperback from Cozy Cat Press. So if you're looking for some fun reads for your dads and grads, there you go. Or for yourself, of course. Read them. Get into it. We're working on number three. I am. Really? No, I am. I have to say that for my mother's, because she's always concerned that I'm not working on it. I am. I just have to do the juggling act. What can you do? You got lots going on, but we'll get it to you. We will. Also, don't forget, if you miss any of the shows, they're all archived for podcasts. You can follow the Amy Beth Arkley Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. Download episodes there. Also at iTunes, NetNow, and, of course, the website, amybetharkley.com. See how all roads lead back there? Symmetry, sort of like the Mad Men beginning and end, right? Everything circling back to everything else. That's how it works. Hey, thanks again going out to Pamela Hogan and Connie Shulman, the great ladies behind a fantastic documentary. You have to see this film. Looks Like Laurie, Sounds Like Laurie, available now on demand. And you can also get it on DVD. We'll post the websites for you so you can find out more about that. Good stuff. Hey, our Pop Americana special, backed by popular demand, this Friday as we launch into the first, believe it or not, unofficial weekend of summer with Memorial Day around the corner. So enjoy your soundtrack as we take you on a virtual tour of the USA. That's all coming up this Friday at noon, and of course thereafter on demand. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, and we're happy to have you aboard. Thanks for tweeting with us in real time. Thanks for talking to us on the blog, social media about Mad Men, other things. Feel free to always do so. The Twitter feed is available 24/7 at AB Writes. You can also chime in and say hi to our producer, Trudy Hart, at Radio Trudy. Friend me on Facebook. We'll hook you up with our Radio Graffiti blog posts, and we had a lot of folks talking about Mad Men throughout the last couple of weeks, and we do appreciate it. Believe me, it's no fun without you. We like the interaction, so continue to participate on all kinds of topics that intrigue you along the way. Do you think Louis C.K. went too far? Did you see? I didn't see it. I heard that on his Saturday Night Live finale, there's so many finales, season finale, that is, on Saturday, he made some jokes that kind of came up to the edge about child molestation and racism, and some people think he went too far. Other people say, hey, you know, that's what comedy does. It pushes the envelope. If you feel uncomfortable, that's a good thing. I don't know. I didn't hear it, so I'm not sure. I read about it. The only thing I can say is Lenny Bruce did the same thing. You know, he pushed a lot of buttons. He was the one that was the first breakout comedian to cross over the line a little bit and push that envelope. So it's okay, I guess, if you have a conscience about it. It's hard to do it on television the way you would maybe in a club. Of course, people do stuff in clubs now, and they get captured by cell phone video because everybody is a journalist, everybody is a communicator now. People can capture that video and then post it. It goes viral, and people get in trouble and sometimes get fired and all that kind of stuff, which isn't good because comedians typically use, you know, their work on the road in various comedy clubs to work their new material and maybe sometimes be a little bluer, a little edgier, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I haven't seen it, so it's hard for me to comment on it. And there are so many more taboos today. It's hard to push the envelope, although then, on the other hand, again, back when Lenny Bruce was doing it was really hard, too. So comedians have to work that tightrope. And some people, like Joy Behar, says you never go too far if you're a comedian. Anything is fair game and should be. But because of the way things go, especially in a club, I don't know about on television, you have to be careful. You know, certain language and that sort of thing, you have to be careful if you get bleeped so many times. I guess they were talking about Kanye West and the Billboard Awards over the weekend. He was bleeped so many times in his performance that people said, why bother doing it that way? You got to know your audience. You got to know your forum, your platform. If you're there on television, it's a national TV show, you might want to clean up your act, so to speak, than if you were doing it in a comedy club or, you know, the same thing with music. Certain lyrics are going to be bleeped out. That's just the way it goes, and you have to comply with those standards. So why sing a song that has to be, most of which has to be bleeped out? I don't know. That's your choice. But remember The Doors on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, when they didn't want him to say, take you higher. They said they would change it, and they didn't change it, and they were never appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show again. Interesting. That, and now we revere that kind of thing. You know, we say, oh, yeah, that was daring. That was bold. So it's all the way you look at it, and sometimes perspective and time gives you that distance. Fascinating stuff indeed. Hey, thanks to the TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters, for keeping us moving. As I said, Pop Americana this Friday. Guest suggestions, concerns, questions, creativity coaching, all at the website, amybetharkowy.com. So I guess we're getting ready to pack it up.
Goodbye, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. We're back tomorrow with another show.
Well, unless we're fired, we'll talk to you then. Goodbye, sweetheart, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah, we won't be fired. We'll talk to you then. We're going to leave you with the song that was the real song, as people have pointed out. It was originally not a Coke ad. It was a peace song. I'd like to teach the world to sing with the New Seekers. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Take care.
I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Through the a lot more to his story, believe me.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out of the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. That's all there is." And then I fell in love with the most wonderful boy in the world. We'd take long walks down by the river, or just sit for hours gazing into each other's eyes. We were so very much in love. And then one day, he went away, and I thought I'd die, but I didn't. And when I didn't, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to love? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep..." I know what you must be saying to yourself. If that's the way she feels about it, why doesn't she just end it all? Oh no, not me. I'm not ready for that final disappointment. 'Cause I know, just as well as I'm standing here talking to you, that when that final moment comes and I'm breathing my last breath, I'll be saying to myself, "Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball.